Chemicals. Jordan, thank you so much for your generous, generous time today. We're so glad to have you on the show. This has been, of course, a long version, extended version, and special edition of Air Cascadia, thanking everybody, Rock Bergeron, and thanking Kathleen Stevens, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris. It is Community Radio, warts and all, KBOO Portland. Please support our membership drive and give us a call. Toll free, 877-500-5266. And stick around. Coming up next, we've got Between the Covers. Today, host David Naiman will be interviewing Alexis Smith about Marrow Island, her brand new novel, which investigates the impact of the losses of the past. That is coming up next on The Boo.
KBOO would like to thank our community partners that donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was donated by Eclectic Kitchen at 4936 Northeast Fremont Street, serving breakfast and lunch 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesday to Sunday. Lunch was provided by Alamir, a restaurant providing Lebanese food and entertainment on 223 Southwest Stark Street. Dinner was provided by Pizza A Go-Go, located at 3240 North Williams, serving pizzas in-house, takeout, or delivery from fresh prepared ingredients and local organic produce since 2002.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. Also, thanks to Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. For more information about Step House Internet Services, call 503-548-2000 or go to stephouse.net. Also, thanks to the Seattle Theater Group, presenting astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Dr. Tyson will explore science as portrayed in pop culture, and tickets and information for his September 20th show are available at portland5.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, the writer Alexis M. Smith, was born and raised here in the Pacific Northwest. Her debut novel, Glaciers, was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award and is still one of the most popular titles put out by Tin House Books. Alexis Smith is here today on Between the Covers, 4 years after our first conversation, to discuss her much-anticipated follow-up to Glaciers, Marrow Island, out from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Whereas Glaciers was often described as quiet, spare, and introspective, Marrow Island has been called a literary page-turner, an ecological thriller, and a post-earthquake mystery. Library Journal calls it a near-perfect read. Kirkus calls it a stunning work of eco-fiction. And Publishers Weekly, in its starred review, says that Smith's story carries the same heft, descriptive nuance, and narrative spark that distinguished her debut. But this time, she more finely hones her character's emotional rhythm and atmospheric location to create a thoroughly eerie reading experience, capped off with a startling conclusion. Welcome back to Between the Covers, Alexis M. Smith.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So before we talk about the story of Marrow Island, I thought maybe we could orient our listeners to the situation of the story. One of the most talked about articles of the last year was the New Yorker article by Catherine Schultz, the big one, which won the Pulitzer Prize, which describes the catastrophic, utterly catastrophic earthquake that we're due for in the Northwest, and which we're completely unprepared for, probably partially because we don't really have an earthquake culture. They don't happen on that level like they do in Japan and California very often. So in Marrow Island, this earthquake has already happened 20 years ago. So tell us what the world is like now. The earthquake has happened. What has happened to the region, and what has the region done since the earthquake?
Well, I obviously wrote the book before Catherine's article came out. So I was imagining an earthquake that wasn't maybe necessarily as catastrophic as she describes, and she describes sort of a worst case scenario, which is really what got everyone so alarmed, I think, and interested in the article. I did a lot of the same kinds of research that she did, excepting I didn't have a budget to go out on boats with geologists and things like that and actually see the physical evidence. But I imagined it was a big earthquake, and big enough to cause sort of man-made disasters post-earthquake. And these are the kind of things that happen when you don't have preparations for infrastructure and just homeowners and so I imagined this up in Puget Sound, and Puget Sound is a basin, as you know, and there are lots of islands, and I imagined what happened on largely what happens in the Sound, and then also what happens specifically on a couple of islands in the San Juans, where in my story, there is a petroleum refinery on one of the islands, and the earthquake and the subsequent waves that come through the Sound devastate those islands by causing chemical spills and whatnot.
So you make an interesting choice time-wise,
yeah.
In the sense that maybe the most obvious choice would be to put the earthquake in the future.
Right.
and you've imagined the earthquake happened in the real historical record in the 90s.
Right.
So 20 years ago, and that the book takes place then in an alternate present instead of an alternate or imagined future. What were you hoping to achieve, or what did that give you to shift the timeline that way so that we recognize the world in some respects, like the technology is going to all be recognizable to us because it's the present tense, but it's an alternate present tense because the history for the last 20 years is different.
Right. I mean, the first reason why I didn't write it in the future is that I don't feel like a science fiction writer. I feel like there are great science fiction writers out there whose imaginations really go into the future in that way. And I really wanted to just talk about what disasters have been like and what they will continue to be like if we don't change our ways, and even if we do change our ways. I mean, many of the climate-based disasters are sort of set in motion already, but so going back in time and imagining a disaster like this was really just a way for me to comment on my feelings that we, despite having witnessed these things happening elsewhere in the world, have not come to grips with it here, and how would the world be different if we had already had that earthquake? And I think probably not very much. I think we would still be facing a lot of the same crises here that we are facing right now. And I think that was just, part of it was also I just wanted to explore the idea that we lived through it. Some of us lived through it. I think just to work out my own personal anxiety about the impending earthquake. And, so that was more the personal agenda that I had. But it was really interesting when I pitched this book, or my agent pitched this book to editors. I had a sort of slew of conversations with editors after they had read the first 100 pages or so. And not all of them, but at least a handful of them had to check with me to make sure that this earthquake hadn't actually happened. They weren't sure. And that sort of told me that this is the way disasters happen, and what I suspected was true, and that things like Katrina happen, and then they sort of dissolve into the common memory of horrible things happening environmentally around us. And then we're not really quite sure if something like this actually did happen.
Yeah.
And there was an earthquake in the Nisqually Basin, 15 years ago or so. And that was somewhat what I based the idea on. Was I was here in Portland, but most of my family was still in Seattle. And we felt it here. I remember the day really vividly. And, so there's this sense of like, oh, did this happen? It may have happened, actually. But especially for people who lived across the country, and they maybe are not as connected. And of course, at that point, the Schultz article hadn't come out yet, so it wasn't in the broader imagination of this idea of the Cascadia subduction zone.
Yeah. Well, one of the things it did for me emotionally to have it not be a looming disaster, but an already happened disaster was interesting, because I remember when you were here talking about glaciers, which shares some of the same concerns around mm-hmm. climate change and environmental destruction. That book feels more elegiac. It's mm-hmm. feels a little bit more like it's mourning a world that's slipping away, and right. we're not going to be able to stop this uh-huh. from happening. The glaciers are mm-hmm. going to disappear.
Right.
And this book, because the catastrophe isn't looming, but behind us, it feels like it shifts the focus emotionally towards, I don't know if I want to say the word hope, but towards what do we do mm-hmm. now?
Yeah.
Because, and I remember when you were talking about glaciers, you said that the first drafts of that book were very despairing, and then you mm-hmm. had your child and, mm-hmm. and you shifted the focus to hope yeah. more. But it feels, because of the placement of the earthquake, it feels like it's even shifted more in Merrill Island. Does that seem right
to you?
Yeah, I
think that's pretty accurate. But I think that it was a little bit selfish of me to set the earthquake in the past. Like at times I wondered if I wasn't risking enough, just as a writer, to push myself into the future and imagine a future where this happens. Say, imagine the actual event unfolding at some point in my lifetime. But I will say that it really did help me come to terms with that anxiety and maybe imagine scenarios in which people I know or types of people that I know will be able to sort of rally afterwards.
I had sort of like a double question around it, because given that we've talked before for 4 years ago and your first book came out maybe 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in that interim, we've continued to be at war, and mm-hmm. The country as a whole and the globe as a global community hasn't come to grips in right. any meaningful way around climate change. So there, yeah. if you were to look at our species 5 years later, you wouldn't have hope that we were... solving the solution,
yeah,
solving
hope,
the problem.
Hope is not necessarily the word that I would use for Merrill Island or for my mindset when I was writing it.
But I guess what my question was around it was, is it harder as these things continue to write something that's about, well, what do we do? Or does it feel even more important and more vital and you feel more compelled to because things aren't getting better?
I definitely think so. I don't think every writer has to write about, you know, what's wrong, whether it's the environment or social justice or racism or, you know, homophobia or war in general. I don't think everyone should. I don't think everyone's art should be involved with those big questions. But I don't know any other way. I don't know any other way. I write things to work through them or imagine my way through them in some regard. And also because I have a lot of empathy. Not that other, you know, writers don't have empathy, but I have a lot of feelings. I feel a lot of feelings. If I have a way to help others feel feelings around those issues, I don't need to give them answers or even give myself answers. It's just, it's sort of, you know, it's a community building kind of thing, if the broader imagination is working on what we do, then perhaps maybe there's hope then.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Alexis M. Smith about her latest book, Merrill Island. Well, let's talk a little bit about the protagonist. Mm-hmm. Well, Merrill Island, in a way, is an important character, uh-huh. both emotionally and geographically in the book. And you mentioned that during the earthquake, an oil refinery mm-hmm. explosion happens.
Right.
And that oil refinery explosion and then the attempts to put out the fire mm-hmm. make Merrill Island uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. And yet this was also a big trauma for our protagonist because mm-hmm. her father worked there and died mm-hmm. in the explosion. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about Lucy Bowen, what she's been up to, because she's sort of abandoned, like Merrill Island has been abandoned as contaminated. She's sort of abandoned her past mm-hmm. and she lives on the mainland now. What has she been up to and what are mm-hmm. her concerns?
Well, she hasn't abandoned it, I guess. She's become an environmental journalist. working in Seattle. She and her mother sort of escaped the islands to Seattle at some point after the quake, when it was possible. So she went to school and grew up without her father, and her mother remarried, and she remarried a developer, a real estate developer. And Lucy herself is sort of she's lost her steady work as a journalist and is sort of floundering, isn't really sure what to do, isn't sure she can make it as a freelancer. And her mother has also given her the keys to this cottage that they lived in, a family cottage they lived in on an adjacent island to Marrow Island. And so she just sort of, in desperation, and also probably in some desire to reconnect with where maybe her career started, was being involved in this disaster. She goes back home to the islands, and after, you know, 20-something years, and she's there. And her best friend is also there and has sort of summoned her in a way. And so there's also a reckoning there.
The post-earthquake Seattle that you picked sort of reminds me of the Portland of now, in the sense that it feels like the earthquake was an excuse for a sort of a wild west of development against the common good, potentially.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So a wild free-for-all of capitalist development in Seattle post-earthquake.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's part of what I was saying about imagining where we would be 20 years after an earthquake, and I think probably not in a very different place. It seems like after the housing crisis, it seems like Wall Street and other, you know, moneyed investors came in and started grabbing up houses and property. And now we have this rental crisis and this housing crisis in a lot of cities. And I imagined that after a big disaster like that, there would be a lot of desperate people who couldn't afford to fix their houses, that couldn't be lived in, and that a similar thing might happen.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to author Alexis M. Smith, the author of Marrow Island. And we're going to invite some people into the studio now to tell you how you can get a copy of Marrow Island, how you can support Between the Covers, and support KABU at large, become a member, or renew your membership.
Hi, I'm Lynn. I'm here with Conch, and we are here to tell you how incredibly easy it is to support all those things David Naiman was just talking about by dialing 877-500-5266, and you can get a copy of Marrow Island, which is in the spirit of the great Margaret Atwood and Ursula K. Le Guin. It explores issues of justice, of direct action, alternative societies with a feminist point of view. It's a kind of futuristic eco-thriller, post-earthquake mystery. And you can get that for a mere $5 a month by calling 877-500-5266. You get a great book. You get to support a great show and a great radio station. Eh, Conch?
Yes, indeed. This is an amazing radio station. If you're one of the folks who's just moved to town and you've been in a city that, in a place that's had traditional broadcast radio.
Devoid of community radio.
Well, you know, it's kind of like walking into a convenience store and there's two things there's two brands of cola in the entire cooler. And they're like, well, this is what we have. We have these two brands of cola. Isn't that enough? I mean, that's what everybody wants, right? Well, maybe you want coffee or tea or beer or wine or something like that. You want like a whole range of stuff. And this is what you get here at KABU. This is author interviews. There's live concerts. There's touring musicians. There's artists talking about theater and comics and film. And there's just 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of local programming. This is an amazing resource, and this is done on a shoestring with dedicated volunteers. And this is what you support when you call toll-free 877-500-KBOO. It's 877-500-5266. You can also go on the web at kboo.fm, up there in the upper right of the kboo.fm homepage. You will see the donate button. You press that and it'll give you everything you need to know. You can even check out thank you gifts online. And, you know, I mean, maybe you get all of your content from the internet, which is great. There's so much out there, but you know, it can be almost like, you know, going into that convenience store and being thirsty, suddenly somebody gives you a fire hose. I mean, there's just so much stuff out there. How do you sort through it? There are folks here like David Naiman who are your curators. They are experts. They bring in incredible authors. They get suggestions from other people. They get suggestions from publishers. And they say, this would be of interest to KBOO listeners. And it is. It is incredible stuff. So you can support this amazing curated content by hundreds of volunteers and a few staff people by calling toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
You know, Dr. David Naiman was on Between the Covers, was voted best local podcast runner-up in this year's Best of Portland Willamette Week poll. He is tirelessly interviewing authors in ways that are meaningful and usually make me want to read the book, but not just as a selling thing. It's he goes into depth. He too is a writer, so he can face these authors on equal footing. And Alexis Smith is the woman that he is talking to this morning for a $60 or $5 a mere $5 a month minimum donation. You can get this really interesting, it sounds to me, book, Merrill Island, that's been described as a literary page turner, we always like that, an ecological thriller, and a post-earthquake mystery. We're all a little interested in what post-earthquake Pacific Northwest is going to be like. And so it's interesting to see what people's imaginations come up to. Imagination, yes, that is something that happens here at KBOO. People are allowed to actually use their imaginations in programming. 877-500-5266 is the number to call to support David's programming Between the Covers. There are many folks that interview people. I've done one or two on Between the Covers. It's a great opportunity. We always read the book. It's a whole half hour talking to the author, not just a 10-minute soundbite. There's no commercial interruption, and the length of time actually gives you some time to get into the meat of the matter. 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm where you can easily click on the donate button, or on our, if you're on a phone, on our mobile app, which you can get at the iTunes or the Android store. It's all easy. It's all peasy. 877-500-5266.
It's true. Lynn has done author interviews. I've done some author interviews. And one of the funniest comments to ever get, you know, we ever get when an author comes in the studio is, wow, you've actually read the book. You know, the hosts here don't just read the blurbs. They don't just read the cover jacket. They actually read the book. And so you find out in-depth questions and answers from these authors. And you find out, you know, maybe I'm not interested in this book. Maybe I think this book is fascinating. Maybe this book would be great as a gift for a family member or a friend. And with the holidays coming up, maybe you would like to give a copy of Merrill Island to a friend or family member for the holidays. $60 pledge of support, $5 a month. You can get it right now, 877-500-KBOO.
Probably my favorite parts of the book are what happens when Lucy's best friend and summon her to Merrill Island, because unbeknownst to the world, there's a colony that has been set up on the island. And I love being with this colony, like and the rituals that you invented. And I'm curious about if you could, first of all, maybe describe some of these rituals, the work prayer and, and some of the other things that are going on in the colony and the purpose of it. But also I'm curious about your familiarity with intentional communities or the research you did around intentional communities.
I actually didn't do a lot of research on intentional communities and intentionally. I avoided other novels that were, based on communes or cults or anything like that, just because I kind of wanted to come at it from my own gut. Like, it's sort of, the colony is, it's started and run by this woman, Sister Jay, who was a nun and left because she felt called to minister to the earth, and she was being, maybe fenced in by her obligations to the church, And she's a very spiritual woman, but and there are spiritual aspects to everything they do at the colony, but it's less God-oriented and more earth-oriented. There's a bit of a matriarchy kind of going on there with Sister J at the head and women in powerful positions. And there are men there as well. And one of the things they do is work prayer, which is the first thing in the morning. They get up and they each have a chore around the farm, or preparing food, or fishing, or, you know, all of the different workings of the colony. Everyone has a chore in the morning, and they go silently and they do their work. And as they do their work, they are in touch with the island and in touch with being humans in space and working together. And that's, I think the work prayer was the first thing that came to me, partly because I find it myself to be kind of I was attracted to the idea, I guess, of living amongst people who all have a kind of peaceful aspect and want to sort of wake up every morning with this goal in mind of all surviving together by each doing his or her part. I find that really, that idea, it's idealistic. It's, you know, it can't happen outside of, in a very large group of people, because everyone has different goals and intentions, but there are only, I think, I forget now because I wrote it so long ago, there are about 50 of them, 40 of them or something so on the island. And it's a small enough group that they are able to do this together. And does that give you
No, that's sense? Great. That's great. And I mean, when we're here, we're talking about like the collapse of publishing and capitalism run amok. And this island is really trying to create an alternate society, mm-hmm. but also a society that's trying to reclaim contaminated land.
Yes.
So they're engaged. They're not like ignoring the world of that's
right.
in peril, but mm-hmm. actually actively trying to engage with the imperiled world at the same time.
Right. Yeah. It's that is their entire goal. It's to go somewhere that needed them the most, which
yeah.
was this place that they had access to, which was the most important thing, but also that needed them. It needed someone to address what had happened and redress it. And they are working together amongst with scientists and students and, you know, the sort of like young idealistic, you know, activist types and herbalists and, you know, just a variety of people who maybe are not called for religious reasons, but are called just for fundamental connection to the earth kind of reasons.
And using all sorts of like gray water systems and mm-hmm. solar technology.
Right.
And
yeah. And I did do quite a bit of research on that, even though it really only comes in at the periphery of the story. It's not necessarily important to the plot, but yeah, there was a lot of research around that, and it did make me a little hopeful, sort of knowing what kind of technology is out there and what's possible.
Well, I wanted to ask you something about the imagining of the Mero colony in relationship to our region, mm-hmm. the Pacific Northwest, because it seems like the Northwest, at least in my mind, it seems like it attracts utopian inspirations or communities mm-hmm. Of all sorts, running the gamut mm-hmm. Ideologically. So the dream of Cascadia, of a sort mm-hmm. of a autonomous region from Northern California to British Columbia, mm-hmm. But also like the Rajneesh compound in Oregon. And even on the right-wing side of things, you could mm-hmm. look at the Malheur occupation
yeah, exactly.
as a right-wing utopian fever dream of some sort.
Sure.
Do you think that is, there's something about like the Pacific Northwest ethos or history, cultural mm-hmm. history, that attracts these sorts of parallel communities or alternate communities to the predominant one?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, there's a romance, the idea of the West in general, not necessarily even just the Pacific Northwest, but there's a romance of gathering up your kin and your your community and making that trek across the wilds and setting up in the land of milk and honey. And it, I think that that, I mean, I find that romantic. And I lived here. I live here and grew up here. It really does feel like a land of many possibilities. And I think that the idea of it being in peril or being in, when you're in a city like Portland or Seattle or San Francisco now, where there are housing crises and people are, say, moving from California to Portland because they can buy a house here and they can't buy one in the Bay or whatever. And you get these, this territorial anger from the people who are already here of just like, no, it's, I was here first. And you know, of course the argument goes like, unless you were a Native American, you were not here first. And, right. And, you know, but that, that kind of, I think that that anger is stirred up because of this place and because of that romance, and that everyone has that kind of romance of the Northwest, everyone who comes here, maybe, that they can carve out their own little space. And it can be perfect. They could make it perfect in their own way. And yeah, I think that's why people get so, so defensive and riled up about it. And I definitely was thinking about that with the island. I mean, it's a fantasy. It's a, who wouldn't just jump at the chance to go to their own island and, right, and the San Juans and just set up their own community?
Yeah. No, I wonder if, to push that even further, if there's a flavor to the literature, it maybe in the Pacific Northwest or at least in the West, around imagined futures or alternate presence, in the sense that, mm-hmm, there seems to be a rise of bioregional, mm-hmm, dystopian climate change,
yeah,
novels. So
yeah,
Eden Lepucky's, mm-hmm, California, and then Claire Vey Watkins'
yeah,
book,
mm-hmm,
but the ones, and I haven't read either of those, so I'm not sure if they fall as similar, mm-hmm, to this or different, but similar to Merrill Island, other Pacific Northwest writers, and I think of Ben Parzibach, mm-hmm, Sherwood Nation,
yeah,
who
absolutely,
I've had on the show and who's interviewed you,
mm-hmm,
which also puts the emphasis on what to do afterwards,
mm-hmm,
but then also Ursula Le Guin, another Portland writer, mm-hmm, and Neal Stephenson in Seattle,
mm-hmm,
it seems like there's an emphasis on how to create utopia out of dystopia rather than, mm-hmm, just a pure dystopian novel. They're not,
yeah,
novels that are about catastrophe as much as they seem to be about human ingenuity in the,
mm-hmm,
face of the catastrophe. And I wondered if you felt like a kinship to regional writers in that sense.
Absolutely. I think that's a great observation. I don't know that I ever quite connected. I mean, obviously, I feel a kinship with Ben's book, but yeah, I think that's a great observation. I definitely do. I feel like a regional writer. I'm really proud to be a regional writer, and I don't know how to write something in which the landscape does not play a huge role. And I think that that is probably what is true with a lot of us, is that we're humans, but we're tied to this landscape and we love it and we want to be able to be responsible humans, I guess, and maybe model that for the people who move here, who aren't, you know, they're awed by this landscape, but they don't necessarily get it yet.
We're talking today to Alexis M. Smith, the author of Merrill Island. Well, one of the powerful women you mentioned is the ex-sister,
mm-hmm,
Sister Janet, who,
mm-hmm,
who is the leader, charismatic leader of Merrill Island.
Mm-hmm.
And in one interview, you were asked whether religion was important to the book, and
uh-huh,
your answer was not religion, but spiritual accountability. And I was wondering,
sure,
if,
yeah,
you could talk about what that means to you, spiritual accountability and in relationship to Merrill Island.
Sure. My parents are not religious. They were sort of hippies, and they were Baha'i for a while, and they were, I went to church with friends sometimes as a kid, but then I ended up in Catholic school sort of randomly. And so I got this really interesting view into Catholicism, and to the sisters who ran my high school in Seattle, the Sisters of the Holy Names. And I got a really interesting education in social justice from them. And in that they, while they were, you know, against abortion, which, and I was very much pro-choice, they were also against the death penalty. And there was a kind of consistency to their way of thinking. And that was the kind of spirituality I wanted to approach. Not necessarily the organized religion with all of the rules and the, you know, the Pope saying on high, like, this is what we think, this is what we do. It was more of the that component that leads you to go out in the world and do something to make things better for other people. And I mean, that's probably part of the reason why I picked an ex-nun as the character, because she comes with all of this. She comes from a patriarchal system, and she breaks out of it to do what she really believes God wants her to do, and she doesn't expect everyone else in the colony to have that same mission from God. She just expects them to have the mission for whatever their reasons are, because they know they need to leave the planet in a better place, or because they want to get out of poverty, or what, you know, whatever it is, and that their accountability to the planet that they live on is their spirituality in that way, or is their religion in that way. Like, if you're accountable to the people around you and their well-being, then why can't you be accountable to the planet and its well-being? And yeah, I mean, that's the idea I was going for.
Yeah, and I was curious about the role you see direct action or alternate economies play in spiritual accountability. We know that mm-hmm. when you read Merrill Island, you'll discover that this community, with all its good intentions, isn't exactly following the laws of the day.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So there can be conflicts between mm-hmm. between
what's legally
what's your vision and also right. just the question of, if you believe deeply in a cause, what are you willing to do for the cause?
Right. Yeah, and I think that I wanted to come up against that, because there are things that they do that they do because they believe they're right, but though they are legally in the wrong, the society around them believes that they're wrong. And one of those things has to do with, not giving too much away, I hope, but the use of psychedelics, which are still, I believe, Schedule 3. Is that what it is? The federal government considers psychedelics to be some of the most dangerous kinds of drugs. Although, you know, the history of the government experimenting with them is one thing, but people at large, just like picking mushrooms, is another, and selling them or using them, so that's one way in which the community is sort of coming up against society at large. And I think that there are a lot of places where people need to make decisions, to take direct action, and whether it's marching in the street and you know, blocking traffic, or it's taking over an empty lot and turning it into a garden, or planting fruit trees on public property, or whatever it is. Like, there are ways of making a point and standing up for your beliefs that are also probably technically illegal, and yeah, they do a few of those. They brush up against a lot of those things on the island.
We've been listening to Alexis M. Smith, the author of Merrill Island, and we're now going to invite some people into the studio to tell you how you can become a member of KBOO, renew your membership, support Between the Covers, and get your own copy of Merrill Island.
Yes, we'll be back to the conversation with Alexis Smith in just a moment. But first, we want to let you know how you can get a copy of this amazing book, Merrill Island.
Absolutely. And if you want to take direct action, this is a great way to do it. To become a member of KBOO, you will be a radio activist. And for a $6.25, is it $6? No,
yes,
for
it
five.
Is.
No. For a mere $5 a month.
Oh, you're right.
I misspoke. For a mere $5 a month, you can get a copy of Merrill Island by author Alexis M. Smith. It's a great, you know, if you're a Pacific Northwesterner, it's always great to hear of sort of just futuristic tales, because we're all wondering about the big one. What will happen? What sort of things will work? This sounds absolutely fascinating to me. I like the part of the fact that people take up and become a community, which is what we have here at KBOO. It's a community. We are your community resource here. 877-500-5266 is the way to contribute. Like I said, a mere $5 a month, and you can have your own copy of Merrill Island. It's a hardcover book, a book with pages and print. It's a really good thing to take your eyes off a screen once in a while and put them back to paper. They feel better. Books have a nice feel to them. Even if you call 877-500-5266, that's 877-500-KBOO, or go to kboo.fm. Like, I had some people to thank.
This is a hardcover book that's got a beautifully designed cover. This slip cover is amazing. $23 value, and yours for only a $60 pledge of support. So you get the membership in KBOO, and you get this gift as well. This would be a great gift membership for somebody in your life who you want to turn on to some great speculative fiction, somebody who you owe a holiday gift to, or somebody that's maybe heading off to school who would like to have some reading on in the time that they're not reading textbooks, or whatever the kids read these days. Are there still textbooks these days?
Not so much, but I one or two maybe. We want to, if you go to kbo.fm, there are a couple people who've done that this morning, Joseph from Seattle and Maura from Hood River, and I bet more to come. It's an easy way to contribute. There's a little red sign that says donate. It's the same thing on our incredibly fabulous mobile app. You guys are smart people. You will figure out right where the donate sign is. It's clear, it's obvious, it's wonderful. Or come on down to 20 Southeast 8th. It's a fine way to make your contribution. You can have a cup of coffee, take a tour of the station, see where we put our millions of dollars into this very frugal operation. It's the best that baling wire and duct tape can do. We are frugal here. We use all the money incredibly wisely. 877-500-5266. That's why we are the community radio station. We're one of the oldest ones in the country. Maybe there's one more that's older than we are. We're almost 50 years old. We want to go for at least another 50 years. And the one way to do it is for you, the listener. It's you. You are listening to me now. You need to call 877-500-5266. The amount that you give is totally up to you. It's the fact that you do it and the satisfaction that you will get from becoming part of this community.
If you've just tuned in, David Naiman is talking on Between the Covers with author Alexis M. Smith, and we're going to head back to that in a couple of minutes. But first, we have just enough time for you to call toll-free 877-500-KBOO. It's 877-500-5266. And get a copy of the book that they're talking about, Merrill Island. Alexis Smith's Merrill Island has been described as a literary page-turner, an ecological thriller, and a post-earthquake mystery. Set in the Pacific Northwest, after the big one has hit the region, we follow environmental journalist Lucy Bowen as she returns to the San Juan Islands, her childhood home, to investigate an intentional community, one led by an ex-nun with a radical utopian aspiration. It's quietly formed in an island thought to be uninhabited due to the oil refinery contamination. Merrill Island, in the spirit of Margaret Atwood and Ursula K. Le Guin, explores issues of environmental justice, of direct action, of alternative societies, all with a feminist point of view. Yours for only a $60 pledge of support, $5 a month, when you go online with kboo.fm or call toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
Absolutely. And, you know, David Naiman, who is the host of the show today, voted best local podcast runner-up Between the Covers this year in the Best of Willamette Week poll. KBOO had a number of folks that showed up on the Best of
Best of Portland
Willamette Week poll. I believe talk shows, which I'm involved in, were also our Portland talk shows were runners up as well. So we're represented here in Portland. We're represented on now in the world because of the internet, and our signal is very strong. You can get us in all parts of the state. Well, not all parts of the valley. Willamette Valley, anyway, and we're down in the gorge, I believe. Anyway,
yes, we are.
Yes. But it doesn't matter because you can go to KBOO.fm. It's good to have terrestrial. It's good to have all accesses to public information, which is what you get here at KBOO. Keep the signal strong. You get the things that you're not going to find on corporate media. We say that a lot because it's true. 877-500-5266 is the number to call. Now is the time to do it. You don't have to procrastinate. It's okay. You can just do it. Pick up your phone. It's easy. If you're driving, pull over to the side, please. 877-500-5266. And back to Between the Covers.
Well, in addition to the fondness that I have to being in the colony and experiencing their rituals, the other thing that I really admired about Merrill Island was the way you portrayed death, both in the colony, and I thought some of the more moving parts of the rituals were around mm-hmm. death, but the way death is portrayed as part of life, and mm-hmm. I mean that in two different ways, and I'm just curious about your thoughts about them. The first one is sort of the existential way mm-hmm. of death is part of life,
right?
No matter what. Mm-hmm. And without mischaracterizing your book, which has a ton of young people in it also who are activists and involved in the book, there's also old people with old bodies, and we have people with dying bodies, and we have mm-hmm. deathbed scenes, and we have taking care of people who are dying, the unglamorous acts of caretaking, mm-hmm. Scenes which seem rarely portrayed in literature, I think. There is something mm-hmm. Very refreshing to see that evoked in a book mm-hmm. for me.
I know exactly the scenes you're talking about. I think that while I was writing this book, my grandmother was dying, and she had sort of been slowly dying of congenitive heart failure for years, and it was torture for her. You know, she was in her prime, a really lively person and a leader and the matriarch of our family, and traveled a lot and was a volunteer and did so much for her family and for the communities that she was a part of. And in some ways, Sister J is modeled on her. But I guess knowing that she was going to pass, that this was a thing that was inevitable, it was going to happen, she wasn't going to be in the world anymore, and watching her deteriorate, it made me think a lot about how we spend time with people in the end, what is important to them. It's sort of a mysterious, when you're looking at it from the outside as a younger person and you feel like death is really far away for you, it's really mysterious. What is, you know, my grandmother couldn't articulate a lot toward the end, so it's not like I could ask her or wanted to ask her, like, what is going through your head? Like, what are you thinking about? What are you feeling existentially, like, what is this process like? And I definitely felt like, with the larger themes of the book, of sort of the disasters and death and resurrection, or that process of what happens just before and just after is really it's fascinating to me, and it's really, I think, a place where more people should be asking questions and looking. Should be, I shouldn't say should be, but you know, it's, I'm really
glad you did. But I mean, it was really refreshing to have that looked at closely,
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, so the other way in which the life death situation seemed interesting to me was the way death was encroaching on life because of environmental destruction, mm-hmm. the over humanization of the world. Mm-hmm. Like a while ago in a different radio program, I interviewed the environmental activist and writer Sandra Steingraber, who had written a memoir about giving birth to her first mm-hmm. child, right. And talked about how human breast milk was the most contaminated food mm-hmm. on the planet because we're at the top of the food chain, right. bioaccumulation, and it's a fatty food, which mm-hmm. is where toxins accumulate. And nevertheless, even with that fact, it is still the most life-sustaining food mm-hmm. for human babies,
yeah.
Even being the most polluted. And there's that sense of not being able to pull that apart in your book, the toxins and the colony in almost intentionally planting itself on contaminated land. Mm-hmm. I mean, where else are you going to plant yourself right. to start a ideological right. revolution of some sort?
Right. And also the idea that this island may seem so toxic. It may seem so toxic that no one could live there, but our entire planet is suffering from the same toxicity. It's not like that island is separate from. It is part of and connected to. And so this questioning of why would they go there if they knew they were putting themselves in danger of becoming ill from the toxicity? And that question of are they just hastening a probability that everyone else is subjected to as well. Why judge that decision if what they're doing is going there to make it better? Why not let them do it?
And mushrooms, which play a big role in this
right.
book,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned the psychedelic mushrooms, but mushrooms in a larger sense play a big role in this book and seem like this perfect symbol in a way mm-hmm. because they're decomposers and
right.
detoxifiers
mm-hmm.
and immune stimulators
right.
And also deadly poisons and
yeah, exactly.
bringers of visions.
Mm-hmm.
They're being used by the colony and
right.
as one of the main tools.
Mm-hmm. So, I think that they are mushrooms really are the prime symbol because of their relationship to death. They're sort of a bridge between the two, between life and death. It's they bring more life from death, and the processes that mycelium go through are it's pretty incredible when you start doing research about what mycelial colonies will do in a forest, in an ecosystem. There's more research that they're helping bees avoid colony collapse and things like that. So but at the same time, yes, I mean, things have to die for them to do their thing and live. And they have the mycelium are almost like brain cells where they send out information and they process information and they can communicate between plants. And why can't they communicate between species? You know, why can't they communicate to humans as well? And I think that was a really, I think that symbol is probably my favorite and the most important for the book itself. And the islands might be symbols or, you know, the wilderness might be a symbol, but mushrooms are definitely the most important. They're at the heart.
And their capacity to be involved in land remediation, mm-hmm. is that based in
yeah.
a scientific
it is, yeah.
reality?
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Yes, from Paul Stamets from up in Olympia, who's written many books about mushrooms. It's where I learned about mycelial remediation, micro-remediation. It's, of course, in my book, is more of a fantasy, the idea that you would deploy it sort of large scale to remediate an environment. But I mean, it feels like an imminent possibility to me. Like, why
yeah.
not? What harm could be done?
But also, I don't know if this stretches the metaphor, but it felt in a way like there was a parallel emotional remediation that Lucy was trying
mm-hmm.
to do by going back to Merrill Island. She's
yeah.
trying to reclaim this uninhabitable emotional
mm-hmm.
space around
exactly.
the death of her dad.
Yeah,
at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So can you tip your hand to anything that you're working on now?
Only very vaguely, because it's still quite murky to me. I refer to it as soup. Sometimes, like in my brain, sometimes it's soup, sometimes it's stew, as it's becoming more solid and real. But I think the next book is going to take on patriarchy in a bigger way than I've ever taken on in fiction. And part of that is recent events. It feels like things have really sort of, you know, when I was a young feminist in the 90s and it was the year of the woman and... you know, you could go to music festivals and buy pro-choice T-shirts, and there wasn't activism so much as this almost like pop culture liberalism and pop culture feminism with Riot Girls. And now it feels like we are so far from that. Not to ignore any advances, but it feels like there's been some slippage and this sort of malicious anti-woman and anti-gay and anti-trans, and there's a lot of sort of around gender. There's just been a lot of pain and death, and a lot of fear is coming out of it with, you know, bathroom laws, and I think a lot of it just comes down to misogyny, and I feel like I need to tackle it, and so I'm working on that.
Well, you'd mentioned with Merrill Island in other interviews that it started with a dream.
Yeah,
and so you had a sort of an image or a set of images that mm-hmm. that prompted it, and how do you find an entry point into this huge topic of confronting misogyny in your next book? Is there a entryway that is more of an image or a scenario that you start with, not to push you to reveal too much?
Yeah, I think it's definitely this time I didn't have a specific dream that sort of laid out a plot for me, but I am sort of drawn to the narratives of many different women that I know who have, whether they're in academia or the arts or they're just working class, you know, working retail, just situations where they have come up against just completely unexpected sexism and what we do about it. And so I have some images that have come sort of out of what these women's lives are like, and nothing that's concrete enough or vivid enough that I could lay it out here. It's still in that, but I need to do more dreaming on it.
Yeah,
let the images come together.
I look forward to it.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for being on Between the Covers again.
Thanks for having me again. It's always great.
You've been listening to Alexis M. Smith, the author of Merrill Island, and we're going to invite some people into the studio for your last chance to get a copy of this ecological feminist literary page-turner. You've been listening to Between the Covers. Give us your support.
Absolutely, and the way you can give us your support is to dial 87... I still say dial occasionally. It's a habit I cannot seem to break. 877, push those buttons, 877-500-5266. Give our phone volunteers 3 minutes of your time, and you will be a member of KABU for $5 a month. You can have a copy of Alexis M. Smith's Merrill Island, which sounds like a really great read. If you've been listening for this extended interview with Dr. David Naiman, it is excellent. 877-500-5266.
Or you can press the button, the donate button, that is, on the KBOO mobile app, available from the Apple or the iTunes or Android stores for free, or online and the regular website, which is kboo.fm. Upper right-hand corner says donate. But yes, you get to, if you call 877-500-KBOO, you get to talk to an expert volunteer who is a wonderful person who has all kinds of advice. Thank you gifts such as this book that's available for a $60 pledge of support, $23 value, the book Merrill Island by Alexis M. Smith. Yes, definitely call 877-500-5266. Just like Peter did from Corbett, he's renewing. Thank you, Peter, out there in the Columbia Gorge. Also out in the Columbia Gorge, Dan is renewing from Hood River. Thank you, Dan. We're getting a lot of people from the Gorge. Nice sunny day out in the Gorge, and we're glad that you're taking a moment out of your day to call in. You can join Peter and Dan by calling toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
Absolutely. Do it, and do it now. Don't procrastinate. It won't make you feel any better to procrastinate. 877-500-5266 to get a copy of this really interesting book. It's been great hearing David talk with Alexis M. Smith this morning. It's always a curiosity to me to listen to people's other imaginings about what will happen after the big earthquake. And there's a lot of that about what's going to happen in the Pacific Northwest. So this is Alexis M. Smith's version of it, and I think you'll find it interesting and definitely be reasonably priced at $5 a month for two things, a KBOO membership, which is invaluable, and this book. $5 a month will get you a copy of it. It will make you a member. It will make you a member of KBOO. I was going to say card carrying, but I don't know if we do that anymore. We don't need to because of the internet. And speaking of which, KBOO.fm is a great, also a great way to become a member if you're at work and or if you're just at home, you don't feel like talking to anybody. KBOO.fm, it's fast. You can still see what gifts there are to be had and get your membership at the same time. It's also a great way to do it. But 877-500-5266 is still pretty easy, and our phone volunteers are know exactly what they're doing, and they will get you on and off the phone in very little time.
We've been feeding your mind all morning with authors such as Alexis M. Smith. Earlier in the day, early in the morning, we had Greg Palast calling in and telling folks about the upcoming election. We had Richard Wolff talking about the economy, all incredible national figures who love to support KBOO, who love to call in whenever they can and talk about the values that you as a community find important. So that is a value that we hope that you put into action by calling 877-500-KBOO. You know, we've been feeding your mind all morning, and we'll be feeding your soul with some Afro-Caribbean music coming up all afternoon, getting some dancing music, getting ready to go. But while that's happening, definitely take that time to either go on KBOO.fm or 877-500-5266. Talk to some volunteers. Or dance your feet over to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Have a little coffee to get you energized. It's free here, and you get to look through maybe the thank you gift box. Or maybe you'd just like to get a copy of that book. Merrill Island, we have a few copies left. They're fantastic. They're hardcover, really great design on the cover, and a really fascinating, well-reviewed book. It's available, Alexis M. Smith's Merrill Island, for $5 a month. Pledge of support, $60, and it is available by calling toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
And I believe very soon we will be having an afternoon of, an amazing afternoon of music. DJ Charlie's getting all ready. He's all ready to roll. Okay. KBOO, Portland.
And you're tuned to Community Radio KBOO.